I'm Rachel Newton.
And I'm Lauren McCall. Welcome to the Heal and Harrow podcast.
The 16th and 17th century Scottish witch trials were one of the darkest periods of Scotland's history. An estimated 2,500 people, mostly women, were executed and many more accused. With Heal and Harrow, we seek to pay a humanising tribute to these women while also exploring historical beliefs in the supernatural and modern-day parallels in our society today.
Our project takes the form of an album and a live show. The music is based on specially commissioned works by celebrated author Mary Kidd. Tales inspired by and in remembrance of real women who were persecuted and tried as witches, and characters from the folkloric tales and mythology enshrined in our oral culture. These stories form part of her brilliant book, We Are All Witches.
In this podcast, we discuss the women who inspired the work, Mary's writing process, and how we went about creating our musical response. We'll also hear excerpts from the stories themselves, read by 10 brilliant women from across Scotland.
Do click the subscribe button to make sure you catch each episode as soon as it's released. And if you would like to rate and review, that would be much appreciated as it really helps us reach more ears. You can find links to purchase our album, Mary's book, and download the story readings in full at healandharrow.com.
This week's episode is Isabel, read by singer and songwriter Catherine Joseph. Here's Mary to tell us more about Isabel.
Isabel's case, you might say her name is the best known of all the Scottish witch accused. We don't actually know what happened to her. We don't know what the outcome was of her trial and whether she was executed, although we think she probably was. We know she was accused of witchcraft in 1662, and we know a lot about her case because she gave 4 confessions, and they are really lurid and, you know, they're full of kind of salacious detail. There's a real kind of theme of prurience runs through all the witch accusations and interrogations. You know, they're really interested in what these women are doing carnally with the devil. You think just dirty minds, you know, kind of getting what they want because they've put people in such impossible positions that they're just saying, okay, yeah, I did do that. I did sleep with the devil. But Isabel kind of obviously had a real deep knowledge of witchcraft traditions, and whether that was just because everybody knew what a witch was supposed to do and she'd heard loads and loads of these stories and she'd sort of synthesized them, or possibly, and I kind of like to think that perhaps she just had a big repository of folklore. Because if you think about, particularly she was from Aldern near Nairn. It's a community where in living memory, it had been really a Gaelic community, but it had increasingly been moving to a sort of lowland Scots culture. So possibly actually she had access almost to 2 traditions. And particularly, I suppose my knowledge is greater of the Gaelic tradition, but it's full of charms and incantations and little ways of, I suppose, magical thinking. And so Isabel sort of just spewed out all this stuff. I've actually got a little quote. When I read this, I'm going to call somebody Douglas. There's a missing bit. It's someone Douglas. Douglas is a surname. I don't know who it was, but I'll just read it as though the word weren't missing. John Taylor and his wife Janet Broadhead from Belnakeith, someone Douglas and myself, all met in the churchyard in Nairn and raised an unchristened child from its grave. And at the end of Bredley's cornfield, just opposite the milne of Nairn, we took the child and clippings from our finger and toenails and wee drops of all sorts of grain and some kale leaves and hacked them all up into little pieces and mixed them together. We put a part of it among the dung heaps on Bredley's land. That way we took away the fruit of his corn and all, and we shared it amongst 2 of our covens. So, you know, we've got kind of a lot of the classic images, you know, we're interfering with the dead, with unchristened children, and, you know, we're chopping up this unchristened child and scattering it about the place. But as I say, there was also kind of really salacious detail about sex with the devil and the temperature of his semen and all sorts. And Isabel gave these confessions in front of kind of a set of local dignitaries, and they were written down and they survived. One of the things about a lot of the witch trials is that the paperwork does not survive. As a process, it was kind of managed partly locally and then partly centrally. So often a local process would send away to the Privy Council for permission to hold a trial. And so that paperwork is more likely to survive in the national archives than it is in the local ones, where obviously, you know, change and fire and flood and hundreds of years means that things just disintegrate and disappear. Hence the fact we don't know what happened to Isabel. But because of these just mad documents, they've really just captured people's imagination. And we've got so much art and music and much written about Isabel. So in some ways, her name has become incredibly well known in the modern era through all of those pieces, rather like Janet Horne, although that might not have been her real name, who is now very well known as the Last Witch. And I think in part because Rhona Munro wrote the play The Last Witch of Scotland, which raised the awareness throughout the country. So there you have Isabel.
How can they have expected you to understand the world should have no magic in it, when your first memory of anything much at all is the night you first saw angels in the sky huddled in your father's arms as he leaped across the dark, green and pink and gold, the merry dancers? When you've lived your whole life with perfect care so that you might never attract the attention of the other ones, little folk that fell from heaven and made their homes in the dark, hidden places of the earth, passing with quick steps by the hillock where an unwary maid dallied long ago, never to be seen again, but only heard, so they say, on a winter's night, when a drunk man might pass that way and swear he heard a woman's voice lamenting. On the night of a wedding, a ring of pins around the sleeping cows would see you would return to milk in the forenoon, and a piece of iron in a child's cradle was a charm all mothers knew against finding that same cradle empty one awful morning. It's in your bones, the knowledge, taken in as if with your mother's milk as it formed them. The falling sickness is cured by a draught of water from the skull of a suicide. A child that is bonny and blithe one day and withers and sickens the next cannot be cured, for it is a changeling and the fairies will never return the real babe once they have it. If a man's gums bleed and you find blue spots on his shins, cut an apple into four, bless each piece with the name of the Trinity and have him eat them up. They don't want to know about that last one. Park, the Laird and the others. Prayers are of no use to them. Not what you say when you rise in the morning or smear the fire at night. Half-remembered blessings you heard from your granny. She had Gaelic, father's mother, and you have none, but for a few half-words here and there.
So how do you then, as a writer, go about writing anything new about Isabel?
Well, I took the highly mature decision not to engage with anything that anyone else had written, had composed. I just thought, I'm just going to go back to what are Isabel's words. And I think the Isabel piece was the first piece I wrote. It's quite short and it's quite angry. And I wrote it in one big sort of just dump. I actually wrote it on my phone, which is extremely unwise, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. I end up with carpal tunnel from typing away these long screeds of text on my phone. But I think I was so angry. I read the confessions and then I thought, this poor woman is in front of all of these men who should be ashamed of themselves. And they're basically perverts, pushing her to tell them that she's done all of these things. And although they said they didn't use violent torture, they had very probably kept her awake. And so what I decided to do was write from, I suppose, my kind of interest in, you know, where did Isabel's knowledge come from? And thinking perhaps some of it was just innocent tradition, the things that people did and said. And I'm just briefly, it's maybe worth noting that there is definitely the witch trials in Scotland are very related to the Reformation religious changes. So some of those charms and incantations, society doesn't want them anymore because they sort of have an association with Catholicism and ritual. And of course, you know, the way that the Reformed religion is going in Scotland, it's absolutely doing away with all of this, what they would have called popery. And so I started and I thought, well, okay, so of course she would have all of these ideas of this magical world. That was the world they lived in. But then she's lost herself. She's had a break with reality. That's why sleep deprivation is effective torture. Eventually, the individual just completely breaks with reality and they'll say anything. It's one of the reasons that it's an idiotic way to elicit a confession if what you actually want is the person to tell you the truth. But of course, generally people who are busy torturing other people just want to hear what they want to hear. And so Isabel, I thought, just gave them what she thought they wanted, but with extra attitude because she really, really hates them. And so she actually, as in the story, she's looking at Park, the landlord who's there watching this. You know, think about the power imbalance of these men who have power in the community and standing, and this one poor woman, she starts to tell him that she killed his children. They died donkey's years before, but she does, she says she killed them. And so actually I'm thinking, what hatred would you have for someone? But she was right to have the hatred for someone to say, actually, I killed your children, it was me. And so I don't believe she thought she was a witch. I think she was a woman in absolute extremis, who had a lot of the ideas of witchcraft in her head and was put in a situation in which she made it real through her words, and we still remember in that way. And I haven't gone back to other people's Isabel, because in some ways I don't know if I want to. I think I've got my own Isabel in my head.
Yeah, I think that's probably similar for us, because, you know, as you say, there's a lot of musical responses to the story of Isabel Gowdy as well. And I think we definitely wanted to make sure that we had our own perspective on that. Because sometimes I think, yeah, when you're writing something about something that's been sort of recreated artistically before, it's important to have that slight tunnel vision about it at the time, just so that you don't have those influences from elsewhere. You just have the story as it is.
I remember, though, that when we first talked about which women we would choose, we kind of went a bit back and forth on Isabel, didn't we? Because we were aware that much had been written and said and made. And was that right? And I'm really glad we did.
Yeah.
Yeah, so am I. And I suppose when we first started, and when you look at the trial records and you're looking at thousands of names, you think, is this too obvious to include Isabel when we're just looking at 10? But yeah, so important. And I'm really, really glad we did.
They tell you that you're lucky, Park and his cronies, for they have laid never a hand on you in all the time they have held you. Witches in other parts have their foot bones broken, they say, or their fingernails drawn out with pincers. In England, Forbes tells you, they swim them, both thumbs tied to their great toes with a cord. Water is too pure for the vile body of a witch, he says, and if she is guilty, it rejects her. His long white nostrils twitch so you're hard-pressed not to smile. It's long been said in these parts that the minister likes women little enough, and if you must send your lad to him on an errand, best advise he keeps his back against the wall. Laughter bubbles up like water through a spring until it chokes you. That turns you to think of some poor old crone bound and floundering in mud and weed, and you feel you could look her in the eye without shame. But it seems to you that you understand what it is to sink into the deep, only to be dragged back up into the light and thrown gasping on the ground with the taste of death in your mouth. It's been days since they let you sleep, and now, when you nod and they jab you, your aim lurches so you fear you'll void your dinner on the floor. Still they jabber on, Dallas and that Dunbar, with tales of pincers and branks and pins to find the secret places the devil has suckled you. You have no idea how long they've had you when your mouth opens of its own accord and you tell them you met the devil in the kirkyard of Aldern. Damn that horse and Forbes with his fondling of children. May the stink cling to his precious kirklike shite. And renounced your baptism. You close your eyes and think of that crone bound and choking in a far-off country and tell them you touched your foot and your thumb to your head and it was your shoulder he suckled. For you're damned if you'll give these clarity-minded bastards a chance to fumble between your legs. You've seen the swelling in Dunbar's breeches as he eyes you.
Back up on what you were saying there about her giving her confession. How many people are we talking about? She was talking to 10, 15.
I'm not sure I remember absolutely. Park the Laird was there and the local minister Forbes. And I think there was a notary. Hang on, I actually have the list. Master Harry Forbes, Minister of the Gospel at Aldern, William Dallas of Cantry, Sheriff Depute of the Sheriffdom of Nairn, Thomas Dunbar of Grange, Alexander Brodie the Younger of Leithen, Alexander Dunbar of Both, James Dunbar, I don't know how to say this, apparent thereof, Henry Hay of Brightmoney, Hugh Hay of Newton, William Dunbar of Clune, is that how you say it? And David Smith and John Weir in Aldern, witnesses to the confession. So, I mean, there's quite a gang of blokes there watching her, isn't there?
That was so striking, looking through the records. We used largely the survey of Scottish witchcraft when we were going about bits of our research. Such an amazing resource. But it's really hard to look at multiple records where you have one woman's name and these multiple men and thinking about that exact scenario that you've just described.
And something we haven't talked about is that they did strip them. And we might talk at another time about witch pricking and what that was, which obviously was a form of physical violence, but whether or not they considered that violent torture is kind of debatable. My Isabel does not want to be stripped in front of these men, and she's got this idea that they would like to touch her. And so that's one of the reasons she gives them what she thinks they want, because there's absolutely no way she's letting them, I think she says, fumble between her legs. And that sort of the idea of the shaming they did. I think it's quite an interesting idea anyway, one woman in front of those men, whatever they were talking to her about. Imagine she'd been accused of petty theft. That's a lot of powerful guys and one woman who has no power and very few rights, really. And, you know, she's there on her own. She's not being defended. She's not being read her rights. You know, she's just there on her own in this awful situation. It's shameful. It's absolutely shameful.
Yeah, it's so stark. And it's interesting what you say about that idea of kind of survival, even in that moment. I suppose sort of imagining what these people might have done to just make their fate slightly more bearable. It's inevitable what's going to happen. But, you know, trying to think about how you can kind of even slightly change that fate for yourself by what you say.
Many of them were, I think, essentially, you know, the strangulation, the mercy of the strangulation before the burning would have also been quite a good motivation to play along. And whether or not people believed that if they made a confession, then, you know, their immortal soul would be in a different position. You know, in these confessions, they're all claiming that they met the devil and all sorts happened and they renounced their baptism. That's the way the ritual works when you meet the devil. It's you have a sort of inversion of a Christian baptism ceremony, according to all of the confessions that we have, or many of them. So in a sense, yeah, I think, you know, they would have been thinking about their afterlife as well. There's no question about that.
Stop. You tell tell them you fucked your master in the Keep at Inslach, and how you and Janet Braidhead raised a child from its grave and some nonsense about ploughing with puddocks. And then you see that bastard park that levies rent, that take the bread from children's mouths and his eyes are shining. This is what he wants. And you find a shard of ice somewhere in your heart and hold to it. And then you are telling the fucker that it was you that killed his children. All those little corpses he sired. It was you and Janet and Margaret Wilson. And then the names pour out of you. Names and more names. So he will never again sleep easy in his bed with the knowledge that half his tenantry hate him with such cold and bitter hatred that they would take his very children from him. And you know you shouldn't do it. Your words will shake your neighbours from their warm cothouses and into the fire, but you can see it in his eyes, the terror and the grief, and you know he will never again rest in a room where the door is not bolted. And so for good measure, you tell him you can turn into a bird at will, a black one, a mocking, jeering jackdaw that stands on the ruins of a man and laughs. And then is more. How you can make the blackest dyes in the devil's vat, and God, it is true. Your heart is black now. If they pierced it, the blood would flow out thick and dark and drown them all in their dirt. It is written down on them. There is sleep.
We used some spoken word in this track. I think when we were kind of making decisions about how we wanted the album to sound and things like that, we weren't sure, were we, at first about using spoken word. I'm just trying to hark back to to those times when we were sort of talking about what we wanted to do. We knew we wanted to include the voice and both of our voices in some way, but we weren't sure how we could best use spoken word on a kind of, you know, musical album. I think we both felt a little bit uncomfortable about it at first, would you say?
Yes, definitely. And in that idea where our, I guess, our mission statement with the project was to kind of humanise and give voice to these women, we thought, is it completely inappropriate that that voice is our voice? And, you know, in that sense of, should it be our voices that are coming through? But to be honest, I think we got to the point where some of your words, Manny, just leapt off the page. And I guess in a way, in the way that so many artists have been inspired by Isabel's confession itself, we were similarly just as inspired by your writing in that sense of that needs to be in the track, that needs to be in the music. And there's certain words and even certain ways that, like, Rachel delivers some of the words that now, even in the gig, I just find them so powerful each time.
I think the fact that your voices are there, I don't think anyone should ever, I mean, I think we can say these are our interpretations, they're our words, but we're using them to pay tribute. And I was once, years ago, as a publisher, involved in a really interesting conversation because a woman had a novelist called Tanya Landman, who's a really great writer for children and young people, young adults mainly. She'd written a book, it was called Passing for White, and it was about a woman who literally escaped from slavery because she could pass, because she was the child of the plantation owner in the Deep South, and she escaped. And Tanya had said she felt really uncomfortable about reading this aloud, you know, in an English white woman's voice. And actually, you know, the comedian Reginald D. Hunter, in this Twitter exchange, he came and somehow kind of clocked this Twitter exchange and said, no, you know, in the end of the day, you're giving voice to someone and you're not claiming you're them and you're not claiming you own them. You're saying this is an important story. And he was saying, in a way, these are all stories about how processes like the witch trials or slavery was about creating division between people. And when we're memorialising, we should be alert to not doing more of that. And I thought that was a beauty. And actually, he came up to the Edinburgh International Book Festival. He read those passages. It was gorgeous, because he's got the most gorgeous voice. It was just lovely. So in a sense, you didn't have to read the passages. He did it. But I found it a really life-affirming conversation.
I think musically, we had quite a lot of discussion initially about how to approach the response to the stories and not be too literal musically. Is that fair to say, Rachel?
Definitely, yeah.
And in Isabel, we've got these kind of two intertwined little melodic elements of more of a jig and a strathspey on the harp. And I think there was quite a definite choice for me to use a viola in that one. There's a strength that comes from that instrument, I suppose. And we were keen that the melody in the track had a bit of a kind of strident, strong feel. But yeah, there's lots of elements.
Yeah.
Certainly in that breakdown a little bit.
Yeah, there's this sort of breakdown where it feels a little bit more, I hate this word, but ethereal. And there's a kind of, a little bit of just non-wordy vocals. And I suppose, for me anyway, the journey that the track takes feels a little bit like, I suppose, imagining that process of being kept awake, all of what Isabel would have gone through and how her mind was dealing with that. And one minute you might feel like you were quite lucid and, you know, you knew what was happening. And then the next minute you might be in this sort of world of your own, and I suppose portray that a little bit, that change in mood.
I also like the fact that there was normality, because you used those little snatches of something that sounded quite, you know, Highland tune, that it kind of had that feel that actually, you know, she was a cotter's wife. She would have worked on the land. We know she helped her husband sell his goods. And, you know, she would have been quite a strong wifey, I think. And sometimes when we think about witchcraft, we do think about these kind of ethereal creatures. And actually, again, it's that idea that actually these are normal women with normal lives. And I loved that, that there was a feel of something quite human and coming through, but then slipping away.
It was definitely a conversation in the early days about, we maybe wanted the overarching sound of the album to feel contemporary, but we wanted to reference sounds or melodies or modes that could have been around at that time. And I guess, as you know, Rachel and I, our initial background being so much in traditional music, we have that connection to some of the music that we play that we grew up with was even being played at that time, which is kind of fascinating. And when I think about that, that sometimes allows to feel a connection to what those people, what their lives might have been like a little bit. We might not know much, like you've touched on previously, Mari, about, you know, what their homes were like or what their living situation was, but we actually still play some tunes that they might have had on the periphery, even if they heard them sung somewhere or diddled. And that's an amazing connection to have with that time.
Yeah, that feels really powerful, doesn't it?
I think I naively imagined the album would be more trad and less its own thing. I've never quite known the word to use. I think in some ways in my head, I was approaching it thinking about what you were going to do far more literally, because it didn't exist at that point. And so I think I was thinking about all different musical traditions and different women from different areas. And actually, that was way too literal. And I can't imagine it in any way different to the way you did it now. And I think actually it's such a weird period of history that you do need to detach, but then you need those anchor points. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And it's kind of that thing of putting your own natural response, but also with that in mind.
I hope Isabel would be pleased.
I hope so.
If she knew. That's one of the things I think I thought, yeah. And I wonder if you guys did too,
yeah.
Is I hope I'm doing these women justice. And I always say, if I'm speaking to an audience about the book particularly, I always say, I'm not claiming that this is true or this is how it was. But, you know, I hope that those women might recognise at least something of what I was trying to do. Were they here today?
You find a shard of ice somewhere in your heart and hold on to it. If they pierced it, the blood would flow out thick and dark and drown them all in their dirt. It is written down, and then there is sleep.
Listening to the Heal and Harrow podcast, produced by us, Heal and Harrow, and recorded and edited by Grant Anderson. All the music you heard is from our self-titled album, with thanks to Mari Kidd and Catherine Joseph.
You can buy our album, a copy of Mary's book We Are All Witches, and hear the stories in full by visiting healandharrow.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate, review and subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Bye for now.